KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump campaigned on getting the U.S. out of foreign policy commitments and ending wars. What has brought the United States so close to joining Israel's war against Iran? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Coming up, an Iranian says even people who protested their government have to support their country now. May Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We also ask what power the United States gained when it claimed a golden share of U.S. steel. Also, the Supreme Court rules on Tennessee's law banning gender-affirming care for minors, and we hear from Nina Totenberg. It's Wednesday, June 18th. This day in 1812, President James Madison signed a declaration of war against Great Britain. By 1814, it was going so poorly that the British burned the White House. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump has made remarks this morning on the continuing conflict between Israel and Iran. Trump won't say whether the U.S. is moving closer to a decision to strike Iranian nuclear facilities. He said, quote, "Nobody knows what I'm going to do." Trump says Iran has reached out to try to negotiate, but he told them that it is very late. Trump also said he'd had it and said, quote, "No more. Then we go blow up all the, you know, all the nuclear stuff that's all over the place there." The U.S. Supreme Court has upheld a Tennessee law that bans gender-affirming care for transgender children. The decision was 6-3. Chief Justice John Roberts says the state law banning the care does not violate the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. That clause requires the government to treat people who are similarly situated the same. Dissenting justices say the ruling abandons trans children and their families to political whims. A new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says for the first time in more than a year, street drug deaths in the U.S. appear to be rising. These include deaths from fentanyl. As NPR's Brian Mann reports, the CDC found roughly 1,400 more drug deaths over a 12-month period.
Fatal overdoses are still far below their peak in 2023, but for the first time in 17 months, a new CDC report based on data collected back in January shows a significant rise in drug deaths. In a statement to NPR, the CDC described this as a fluctuation and a slight increase and said researchers are working to better understand the trend. Some drug policy experts said this could turn out to be a blip in the nation's recovery from fentanyl and other street drugs. But Keith Humphreys, a researcher at Stanford University, said this could be a warning sign that recent dramatic improvements in fatal overdoses could slow or be reversed. This increase comes at a moment when Congress and the Trump administration are considering deep cuts to federal funds for addiction care. Brian Mann, NPR News.
The National Weather Service has issued its first ever heat advisory for Alaska. From member station KUAC, Shelby Herbert has more.
Unlike extreme cold, it's not easy for people in Alaska's interior to manage unusually hot weather. People in Fairbanks are scrambling to keep themselves and their pets cool. Staff at the local animal shelter are pro-offering kiddie pools and peanut butter popsicles for the pups. The state is warming 2 to 3 times faster than the global average, and the summer heat beats down on the many buildings in the region that don't have air conditioning. It's a 1-2 punch, according to meteorologist Jason Laney.
It also tends to kind of build in with the same time as wildfire season.
The heat is coupled with smoke pouring in from wildfires in Canada, so many Fairbanksans can't even crack open a window for relief. For NPR News, I'm Shelby Herbert in Fairbanks.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 250 points. It's NPR. The top official in the National Response Coordination Center for Federal Disasters has quit. Jeremy Greenberg has led the Federal Emergency Management Agency office since 2020. This FEMA office makes sure that all equipment and personnel quickly gets to where it's needed after hurricanes, fires, and other disasters. President Trump has said FEMA will be closed as soon as the end of this year. The bogong moth of Australia travels more than 600 miles in the spring and then again in the fall. NPR's Ari Daniel reports researchers now know how the moths manage to find their way.
Previous work revealed that the Earth's magnetic field helps the moths orient.
But they couldn't use
only the Earth's magnetic field. They needed something visual to go with it.
Andrea Adden is a neurobiologist at the Francis Crick Institute, and she thought that visual cue might come from the Milky Way. So she and her colleagues caught moths in the mountains and ran them through a couple of experiments, including one that involved placing them inside a mini planetarium with a projection of the night sky, and another that monitored the insect's brain activity. And they found the moths were using the starry sky as a compass cue to orient and navigate, a first for an invertebrate. Ari Daniel, NPR News.
The Department of Homeland Security says Secretary Kristi Noem was taken by ambulance to a hospital in Washington yesterday. She had suffered an allergic reaction. The agency says that Noem is recovering. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And May Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Coming up, a New York mayoral candidate was arrested by federal officials for escorting a migrant out of immigration court. But first, President Trump once distanced himself from Israel's military action. Now he's taking some ownership.
The president is talking in terms of we when he discusses Israel's war against Iran. He's even saying the United States could take out, his words, the supreme leader of Iran, calling Ayatollah Ali Khamenei an easy target who is only safe for now. The president has faced some pushback from his own political allies who oppose American involvement.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez has been covering this. So, Franco, President Trump spent the afternoon yesterday with his national security team in the Situation Room. What are the chances of deeper United States involvement here?
Yeah, that's the big question, and that was being debated in the Situation Room, you know, the future of U.S. action in this conflict. I mean, Trump has repeatedly said all options are on the table. He's drawn a red line if soldiers are targeted, but he's also signaling the U.S. is already more involved than the White House previously let on. Just as Steve was pointing out, he's boasting that, quote, we now have total complete control of the skies over Iran. He's saying we know where the supreme leader is. I mean, he's repeatedly using that word, we, blurring the line between Israel's objective and U.S. objectives. You know, and taking that kind of ownership has really raised more concerns of the U.S. getting more involved into another foreign conflict.
Yeah, so that's interesting because some of the people who are most concerned about foreign involvement are allies of President Trump. So tell us more about this friction.
Yeah, for someone who has such dedicated supporters, it's really notable that some of Trump's longtime backers are questioning his judgment here. Trump, of course, has long been known for his America First message. And some key conservative allies, such as former Fox News host Tucker Carlson and Trump's former White House aide Steve Bannon, see Trump straying from America First and are pressing him to stay out of this fight. Here's Carlson explaining his position on Bannon's podcast, War Room.
My interest is really simple. I don't want the United States enmeshed in another Middle Eastern war that doesn't serve our interests.
Now, Trump campaigned on ending long wars, peace through strength, he would say. I also spoke with Brett Bruen, who served as the White House Director of Global Engagement in the Obama administration. He said Trump supporters thought they were getting a president who was going to disentangle the U.S. from overseas commitments.
What they're seeing, however, is a president who is getting pulled back in to a foreign crisis that another country started and that the U.S. interests remain somewhat questionable.
Okay, so how is President Trump responding to these criticisms?
Well, he's pushing back, especially against Carlson. Trump posted on social media, quote, "Somebody please explain to kooky Tucker Carlson that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon."
No, you know, you mentioned enrichment. I remember like a few weeks ago, Trump had actually been talking about a deal right before the most recent strike. So does this latest stance mean that diplomacy is now completely over?
Yeah, I mean, right now, Trump doesn't appear to be interested in diplomacy. He told reporters he's not in the mood to negotiate. What we don't know is whether at the same time this tough talk is part of his strategy to further pressure Iran, because he's also said he may send Vance and Special Envoy Steve Witkoff to negotiate, though perhaps not right now.
All right, that's White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
Now we have a view from inside Iran. Sadereh Sadiki is an assistant professor at the University of Tehran's Faculty of World Studies, and as you would expect, the perspective you're about to hear is radically different than what you would hear outside her country. We reached Sadiki earlier today in Isfahan, a city that has a nuclear facility that has been hit in recent days by Israeli airstrikes. What have your last few days been like?
Well, it's been following the news and calling families and friends and checking on them to make sure they're safe. It's been stressful, but we're holding up and we're checking on each other and we're giving each other hopes and strengthening each other to go through this and to come out of it victorious, as Iran has always done.
We are, of course, talking with anybody we can find across Iran at this moment, and I was exchanging messages yesterday with a man who lives in Tehran, the capital, who fled to another city, as a lot of people are in Tehran.
Just a few minutes ago, I was talking to a colleague who has a two-year-old, and I was telling her, don't you think it's safer to just move outside Tehran and go somewhere? And she was telling me that this is her home and she wants to stay here. And so it's mixed feelings. And a lot of people have chosen to stay in their houses. You see even the younger generation posting videos of themselves from Tehran. The people that were probably part of the protest back 3 years ago, they're posting pictures of themselves and saying that they are from Tehran, they want to stay there, and they want to protect their country.
I want to clarify what you just said there when you talked about the protests 3 years ago. At that time, a lot of people were protesting against the rules for dress for women, protesting against the death of a young woman in police custody. And you're saying that you believe some of those people are on the side of the government in this situation. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, it's not the side of the government only. It's the side of Iran, because Israel is not attacking the Islamic Republic. Israel is attacking Iran and plus 90 million nation. And they understand that. When you kill civilians while they're sleeping in their houses and apartments, while they're walking down the streets, then people will start to realize that you do not care about them.
I guess we should mention Israel has accused Iran of having a secret nuclear weapons program. That's their justification for this attack. Iran has always denied that it is seeking a nuclear weapon. Setting aside the competing claims, what do you think of the idea of your country having a nuclear weapon?
Well, Israel has been saying for about 20 years at least that Iran is 1 month away from possessing a nuclear weapon. While I totally disagree with nuclear weapons, I think if Israel, Pakistan, India, the U.S., France, and other countries have the right to have nuclear weapons, then any other country should also have it. And Iran doesn't have one. So if there is any threat of nuclear weapons or the using of nuclear weapons, it's definitely the Israeli regime.
When Israel accuses Iran of being a short period of time away from a nuclear weapon, which they have said for many years, what is typically being discussed there is the breakout time. The idea being that if Iran went for a nuclear weapon, if they started to go for a nuclear weapon, they would be able to do it in that period of time. When you talk about who is attacking whom, I suppose people will want to mention that since 1979, Iran has called for the elimination of Israel and has battled Israel through proxy groups in a variety of different ways. Do you see Iran as being entirely innocent here?
Of course, I see Iran as entirely being innocent here because Iran has been threatened by Israel. So far, whatever Iran has done has been in for deterrence. Iran has never started a war. And you're saying that Iran has called for the elimination of the state of Israel. Iran has never called for the elimination of a people, but an occupying regime that has stolen land from people and has been a colonial project of the Zionist entity has been called for responsibility for the genocide and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians and Lebanese by many people, including international community. So I think it's ludicrous to think that Iran, which has not done any of those things, is a threat and wants to eliminate another quote-unquote country.
The United States government seems to be weighing whether and how to be involved in this war. What message, if any, would you send to Americans who are following this conflict?
I think it's important to remind American citizens that there is normal life going on in Tehran, and these policies affect ordinary people. And when war starts, it does not distinguish between pro-government and anti-government citizens. It kills everyone, and that's what Israel has been doing. So I think highlighting a normal life in Iran is very important. That's what Israel is trying to take away from Iranians.
Satareh Sadiki is an assistant professor at the University of Tehran and is currently in the city of Isfahan, Iran. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
A perspective from the other side, one of many voices we're hearing. Now, since that conversation was recorded, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, has given a statement read by a television presenter saying that Iran will not accept President Trump's demand for a surrender, and he warned of irreparable damage if the U.S. attacks. We'll bring you more as we learn it.
A New York City politician was arrested by federal agents and detained for several hours yesterday as he tried to escort a man out of a routine immigration hearing who immigration agents wanted to arrest. Reporter Gwen Hogan with the local news website The City has more.
Brad Lander is New York City's controller, or fiscal watchdog, who is also running for mayor. The Democratic primary is fast approaching next week. And yesterday, when Lander went to escort immigrants safely out of court, he himself was taken into custody. Lander had locked arms with a Venezuelan man who was trying to leave an immigration courtroom. The two were surrounded by masked federal agents who'd been waiting in the hallway.
Do you have a judicial warrant?
Lander asked repeatedly to see the agent's arrest warrant, refusing to let go of the man's arm.
I will let go when you show me the judicial warrant.
Where is it?
Eventually, federal agents overpowered the two men and detained them both. In a statement, Department of Homeland Security Assistant Secretary Trisha McLaughlin said, quote, Lander was arrested for assaulting law enforcement and impeding a federal officer, unquote. But hours later, Lander was released without charges. He told a crowd of supporters gathered outside he was able to return to his family that night. But the man ICE detained was not so lucky.
He has been stripped of his due process rights.
That's right.
In a country that is supposed to be founded on equal justice under law.
Lander is the latest elected official to face arrest during confrontations over President Trump's aggressive immigration policies. But Lander said he was undeterred and promised to accompany more people at immigration court soon. For NPR News, I'm Gwen Hogan in New York.
This is NPR News.
the next fresh air. Dan Taberski, creator of the podcasts Missing Richard Simmons, 9/12, and Hysterical, which recently won an Ambie Podcast of the Year award, talks about why he's drawn to stories at the intersection of obsession, mystery, and culture. Hysterical investigates an outbreak of mysterious symptoms among teenage girls. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From Linda Mood Bell Learning Centers, one-to-one instruction to help students catch up or get ahead. Online or in-person instruction for reading, comprehension, and math. lindamoodbell.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The United States is supporting a Japanese company's takeover of U.S. Steel in exchange for a share of power. It's called a golden share, making the U.S. like a corporate shareholder of the company, only a little more so. Nippon Steel had to make that concession in order to finalize its acquisition of U.S. Steel, which it did this morning. The concession allows the Trump administration to enforce other promises Nippon made, like investing $14 billion into U.S. Steel. Industrial policy expert Todd Tucker told us there are precedents for this arrangement.
A golden share is a mechanism that governments around the world have used to ensure national ownership and control over strategically important industries. So, you know, there's companies like Volkswagen in Germany, entities like the Heathrow Airport in the UK, where the government retains a golden share, which means that they have a say-so over any attempt to sell the company or sort of fundamentally reorganize what the company is trying to do.
Okay, so first you've told me that this is not a name that was developed by the Trump administration, where a lot of things are named after gold, the gold card and the gold decorations in the White House and so forth. This is like a normal term that people have used elsewhere in the world.
This is a normal term, and in fact, sort of the contemporary usage goes back to the United Kingdom, where during the Thatcher period, she instituted a policy of privatizing a lot of the publicly held companies. And sort of the compromise that she worked out was leaving the government with a golden share.
The way you're describing it, it sounds like veto power as opposed to power to affirmatively tell a company to do something.
It's a little more than that. The company will need to be consulting the government on a range of strategically important decisions, whether that's closing a plant, whether that's sort of changing the nature of the investment that they're going to be undertaking. So, you know, this will be a lot like other board seats.
I'm particularly interested in the $14 billion because I believe that investment is supposed to be over a number of years. And of course, you always wonder if the investment in the out years will materialize.
Yeah. And so this was the big sticking point during the Biden administration years, which is that this is a company, U.S. Steel and Nippon, that had a bit of a trust deficit with the public, with their workforce. They had made promises in the past that they hadn't lived up to. You know, steel is too important of an industry. We only have a handful of virgin steel facilities left in the U.S., and U.S. Steel controls about half of them. And the Biden administration just didn't think there would be a way to trust that the commitment that the company made today would stay true, you know, in the years ahead. And so this is actually an ingenious solution to that problem, which is to sort of say, okay, if we don't trust that you're going to do the right thing, we're going to sit on the board and make sure that you do the right thing.
Suppose Nippon doesn't do something that they have agreed to do. What would the United States be able to do to punish them using this golden share?
Well, I think, you know, what the U.S. is showing that it can do with the golden share is basically engage in a partial nationalization of the company. If the company just says, you know what, the private markets aren't smiling on our $14 billion investment, the U.S. government can say, okay, well, then we're going to run this more fully as a public company than even we did with this sort of intermediate step of the golden share.
So there's that implied threat of even more control.
That's right.
Does somebody at Nippon Steel, or for that matter, somebody at U.S. Steel, have to worry now about governmental mission creep? this president or a future president says, you know, I have this influence over your company. I sure think it'd be a great idea if you put all your assets into cryptocurrency, my meme coin, just hypothetically.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, this is a risk. Any company that seeks the approval of the government for this kind of action does run the risk that the government wants to get more involved. So, you know, Nippon opened up this possibility by seeking the merger in the first place. So now, absolutely, you know, there's maybe a good version of this, which is that you could imagine a future administration pushing the steel industry into doing green steel. That would be, from my point of view, a great thing. However, on the other hand, it also means that there's going to be folks that Trump appoints that can be, you know, dictating various aspects of the company's investment portfolio and other business decisions. And so, yeah, that could also run the risk of some corruption.
Todd Tucker, thanks so much for your time.
Glad to be with you. Thanks.
He's Director of Industrial Policy and Trade at the Roosevelt Institute.
Conspiracy theorist and InfoWars host Alex Jones is being sued again. Families whose children were killed in the Sandy Hook school shooting won more than $1 billion in judgments against Jones for defamation. The new suit from a federal bankruptcy official accuses Jones of illegally trying to squirrel away his money to avoid paying up. Here's NPR's Tobias Smith.
Textbook fraud is how the U.S. bankruptcy trustee described it. He accuses Jones of a, quote, flurry of last-minute sales and transfers to his father, his ex-wife, and his kids' trust. Those included cars, condos, cash, and a ranch, all totaling some $5 million. In three lawsuits, bankruptcy trustee Christopher Murray says Jones was trying to keep it all from the Sandy Hook families who have yet to be paid for the massive judgments they won after Jones spread lies that their kids were never actually killed and his followers tormented them for years. Murray says Jones went to, quote, extraordinary lengths using sham transactions to try to hide his assets. One of the family's attorneys, Chris Matty, says they've long suspected what he calls Jones's shenanigans, and they're now one step closer to getting any hidden assets back.
Very good news that there's now a legal mechanism to claw back money that he has transferred. So now it's just a question of collecting every penny he has, and it's obviously going to be far short of the $1.4 billion, but it's going to be what he has.
Attorneys for Jones and his father did not respond to requests for comment. Jones's ex-wife called the lawsuits harassment, according to the AP. Jones has long insisted he could not afford to pay the families even a fraction of what they're owed, as he did in this video he posted in 2023.
We are literally on empty. The money doesn't exist. So I don't like to laugh at these people, but I mean, I don't know how you don't.
Jones is now entitled to a trial on whether the money did exist and whether he intentionally made it go away. Experts say it looks like the trustee has got the receipts.
These types of transactions are as old as time itself. Jones shouldn't be surprised when he's on the losing end of these lawsuits later on.
Bruce Markell is a former federal bankruptcy judge and now professor at Northwestern Pritzker School of Law.
Jones is clearly in the crosshairs of the trustee, and the trustee has a fairly accurate rifle.
It could be more than a year before any trial on whether Jones intended to defraud the families. For now, their attorneys say the families will continue to pursue the assets Jones still has. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
PEPFAR, the U.S. global HIV-AIDS program, supported millions of AIDS orphans and vulnerable children. Now, many of them have no support after massive cuts to foreign aid.
She has no chance unless someone can get her medicine in the middle of rural Zambia. Who's going to do that?
I'm Juana Summers, the story of one child and a pastor's quest to help her on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Iran's supreme leader is telling his country that Iran will not surrender. In a national address, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei also warned that if the U.S. military intervenes in its conflict with Israel, it would lead to, quote, irreparable harm. At the White House, flanked by a crew hired to install flagpoles, President Trump did not rule out the possibility of military action when he took a reporter's question.
I may do it. I may not do it. I mean, nobody knows what I'm going to do. I can tell you this, that Iran's got a lot of trouble.
In a major legal setback for transgender rights, the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming care for trans youth. The high court ruled 6-3 in favor of a state law that bars minors in Tennessee from receiving gender transition surgery, hormone therapy, or puberty blockers. Trans rights advocates argue the ban is a form of discrimination and is unconstitutional. The curfew imposed in downtown L.A. because of immigration-related unrest is lifted, but grocer Juan Ibarra says business is dried up because of fear.
It's a ghost town pretty much right now. No traffic, nothing. No food. You know, all the good food places are closed right now, so it's kind of rough. You know, it's kind of scary, almost like COVID-like.
President Trump says he's taking violent criminals off the streets. Critics argue law-abiding people are being detained. From Washington, this is NPR News. The president has nominated Ted Cook to be the next commissioner at the Bureau of Reclamation. From member station KUNC, Alex Hager reports he'll be the top federal official working on the Colorado River.
Cook spent 7 years managing the Central Arizona Project, which brings Colorado River water to the Phoenix area. Sharon Megdal used to work alongside Cook. She's now a water policy expert at the University of Arizona.
I have great admiration for Ted's skills. He's thorough, he's deliberative, he looks for solutions. And boy, we need to find solutions right now.
If confirmed, Cook will step into the role as seven Western states are in the middle of tense negotiations about how to cut back on water use. He and other federal leaders will try to bring them toward agreement about sharing the shrinking water supply for 40 million people. For NPR News, I'm Alex Hager in Fort Collins, Colorado.
Astronomers are sharing an out-of-this-world panoramic shot of the NGC 253 galaxy, a.k.a. Sculptor, 11 million light-years away. Scores of exposures make up the brilliance of a star-packed photo. Nearly the entire so-called Starburst galaxy. The Associated Press reports scientists observe the nearby galaxy from Chile through the European Southern Observatory's Very Large Telescope. That's what it's called, the Very Large Telescope. More details expected to be published in the journal Astronomy and Astrophysics. It's NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. The Department of Homeland Security says it is still targeting industries that employ lots of people without legal status.
Employers in agriculture, construction, hospitality have worried about losing their workforces to immigration raids. And several raids last week heightened their concern. And even President Trump said he worried about losing, quote, very good longtime workers. Now DHS has clarified what they intend to do.
NPR immigration policy reporter Jimena Bustillo is in our studios. Good to see you.
Good morning.
Is the administration acting on the president's concern by calling off some enforcement?
You know, there really has been a lot of inconsistent messages.
messaging, and that really stems from there's two schools of thought, primarily within the Republican Party, on how to handle workers without legal status. The first faction, you know, is really understanding that their communities and industries are heavily reliant on workers without legal status, and that if those workers were just to go away, entire local economies and supply chains would fall apart. And these are in areas that are very red, Republican, and industries that generally back the president. But then there's this other group, and it's the part of the base that wants to increase deportations no matter what, no matter who. And these are the folks that hold very high-level positions within the administration, thinking like White House borders are Tom Homan, Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller, DHS Secretary Kristi Noem. They're pushing immigration officials to arrest up to 3,000 people a day in order to achieve the president's goal of mass deportations.
Okay, so that's the conflict. What has actually been happening on the ground?
So until recently, the agriculture sector had generally been left alone. But then last week, we saw several instances of immigration officers arresting and targeting the ag sector. Particularly 70 people were arrested at a meatpacking plant in Nebraska. Several farms got targeted in California and a dairy farm in New Mexico as well. And that really sent employers and workers into high alert. The next day, President Trump once again promised to find a solution for farmers specifically, posting on Truth Social that these workers needed to be protected. But then again this week, we're seeing the Department of Homeland Security double down again, kind of a bit of a whiplash for this industry. Assistant Secretary of Public Affairs Tricia McLaughlin has said that there's no safe spaces for industries who, quote, harbor violent criminals, and that worksite enforcement remains a cornerstone of their efforts.
Meaning that these raids can go ahead, anybody can be targeted at any time.
Correct.
So how are employers and employees preparing for that?
So advocates representing employers have told me that they continue to be concerned. You know, they underscore that they want to follow the law, and many times they believe that they are. But they say that even if they think all their employees have work authorization, they know that doesn't mean their families or their friends or people in their communities have legal status. And that is what leads us into what the administration is calling collateral arrests, which means if one person is targeted, anyone that happens to be around them at the time that they're arrested also gets arrested if they have, you know, lack legal status or something needs to be questioned. You know, we still don't know what the White House's solutions are for the farming industry, despite months of promises that there will be something. But that also means there will be continued pressure on, you know, coming from some of these key industries in the United States that could be a hurdle for what the president wants to do.
NPR's Jimena Bustillo, thanks for the update.
Thank you.
We have some news developing this morning, another busy news day, as they all seem to be. The Supreme Court has upheld a Tennessee law on transgender minors. The law bans certain medical treatments for them. This vote fell 6-3 along ideological lines, with Chief Justice John Roberts writing for the court's conservative majority. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg is in our studio to talk about this. Nina, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Always good to see you. Now, I know sometimes when Roberts writes an opinion, he makes it very, very narrow, judges as little as he can get away with. But how broad is this opinion?
It's broad. Remember, this case was brought by transgender children and their parents in Tennessee who claimed that the state ban on hormones and puberty blockers for children who suffer from gender dysphoria was discriminatory because they said these same medications are permitted under state law for other minors who suffer from other conditions like early onset or late onset puberty. Today, Chief Justice Roberts, writing for the court majority, applied the lowest level of legal scrutiny to the state law. It's called rational basis, meaning basically if there's any rational justification for the law, it passes constitutional muster.
Okay.
And as the Chief Justice put it, this case carries with it the weight of fierce scientific and policy debates about safety, efficacy, and propriety of medical treatments in an evolving field. The voices in these debates raise serious concerns, and the implications are all profound. But the court's role, he said, is only to ensure that the law does not violate the Equal Protection Clause. And having concluded that it does not, we leave questions regarding this policy to the people, their elected representatives, and the democratic process. And I should add here, Steve, that there are 25 states, fully half the states, that have similar bans, or if we include Tennessee, that have bans.
Okay, so this is a big deal that Justice Roberts has effectively said, not my job, it's not my role to decide on this, we'll leave it to the legislatures. But what did the dissenters say?
In a rare oral dissent from the bench, Justice Sonia Sotomayor said that because Tennessee law expressly classifies on the basis of sex and transgender status, the Constitution and settled precedent require the court to subject it to a higher level of scrutiny, not the low rational basis test. Hmm. The majority, she said, contorts logic and precedent to say otherwise. The court authorizes, without second thought, untold harm to transgender children and the families who love them by retreating from meaningful judicial review exactly when it matters most. And the court abandons transgender children and their families to the political whims of the times. In sadness, she said, I dissent.
Hmm. It's just interesting to realize once again how much power the court has in just when it decides it's their business or not their business. You said it's a broad ruling, but does it leave some things unresolved?
Well, it leaves it to the states to do what they want on this score, at least until more information might suggest that the scientific data that is wrong. You know, this is an area where there is new data that suggests, I don't say conclusively proves, but suggests that maybe treating gender dysphoria has real downsides. And so basically this leaves it to the states. And I'm assuming that about half the states will have bans and half the states will not. And kids will have to travel to other states to get treatment.
NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, thanks so much as always.
Thank you, Steve.
This is NPR News.
Israel and Iran launch strikes at each other. We're taking a look at the U.S. role in the region, including the Reagan-era Iran-Contra scandal. That's next up on Here and Now.
With everything from groceries to orthodontics, yes, really, available on demand, why not public radio? Make playing NPR or this station part of your smart speaker routine to stay informed on your schedule.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep with news you can relish. Joey Chestnut and the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest are squashing their beef. The competitive eater skipped last year's fight over a contract dispute. He had signed a deal with Impossible Foods. After some contract tweaks, Chestnut is once again aiming for the Wiener's Circle. Winner's Circle. Last year's champ ate 58 hot dogs. Frankly, the champ may now have to catch up. Chestnut's record is 76. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonprofit research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. Inflation is much lower than it was a few years ago, but that just means prices aren't increasing as fast, not that they're going down. Prices at the grocery store are still higher than they were before the pandemic, and along the U.S. southern border, some families find savings by grocery shopping in Mexico. Angela Corcherga reports.
In a brightly lit grocery store in Juarez, music sets a festive mood. Savvy shopper Diana Garcia is in the produce section looking for the best prices. The Juarez mother says she sees a lot of people from the U.S. buying groceries here. And more are doing so, Garcia says, because of the strong dollar to peso exchange rate. Stretching that dollar is a necessity for families coping with higher food prices on the U.S. side of the border. Cristina Castruita and her husband routinely shop in Juarez, which borders El Paso.
We've been doing it since the kids were babies, especially because the formula is half the cost in Mexico than it is in El Paso, and it's a better name brand too.
Castruita says now she shops for cheaper brand name laundry detergent for her boys aged 8 and 10. Her oldest son, Alfredo, chimes in with his own price-saving favorites.
A lot of fruits, they're bigger, less expensive, they taste better. The watermelons tend to be nicer.
Watermelons are allowed, but some produce is prohibited by the U.S. because it could carry agricultural pests. His mother says when it comes to fruit and other items, she likes the variety available in Mexico.
We buy a lot of things like yogurt because we have, not only is it cheaper, but we have really exotic and different flavors available.
The dairy section in most Mexican grocery stores is much larger. Other items the family buys?
We prefer Mexican ketchup also, and of course tortillas. We buy them in bulk and then freeze them.
Generations on the border have looked to Mexico for lower prices and a wider selection, and vice versa. Shoppers from Mexico also cross into the U.S. for certain items, including clothes and electronics. Tom Fullerton is a professor of economics at the University of Texas at El Paso.
That's sort of the holy trinity of retail economics, when consumers can have access to lower prices, better quality, and more variety.
A survey by the city of El Paso just months before the pandemic found local residents spend about $352 million a year on groceries in Mexico. Fullerton tracks the border economic outlook in this region in an annual report. He expects higher U.S. tariffs to affect shopping behavior all along the border.
From Brownsville all the way to San Diego, they'll cross the border and take advantage of lower prices as a consequence of what in effect would amount to a federal sales tax.
Beyond chasing cheaper prices, it's a way of life on the border. The kids get a haircut, the family enjoys a meal, and time with other relatives, all in Mexico. Castruita says there are many reasons to spend an afternoon across the border.
To save myself some money, to expose the kids to their culture, and just for fun. It's cheaper and delicious.
For NPR News, I'm Angela Cocherga in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Climate change intensifies storms, and that adds to destruction, which can sometimes create an opportunity to rebuild better and stronger. But NPR and our partners at the PBS series Frontline found that recovery often gets bogged down. NPR's Laura Sullivan reports on how that keeps Americans vulnerable.
Nothing about surviving a hurricane was ever going to be easy. But in western North Carolina, in the months after Helene, we found people struggling to get on the same page. Kit Kramer, the head of the local Chamber of Commerce, walked along the empty streets of Biltmore Village, a once bustling tourist area in Asheville.
Right now, we need the jobs, we need visitors, we need customers.
She says the priority is to reopen, even if it means rebuilding the same as before in a place that floods repeatedly.
It can come back better, and I want that to happen over time. But right now, we need the jobs.
But Asheville Mayor Esther Mannheimer has been trying to convince people to elevate properties and build them stronger.
We could lessen the overall disruption to a community, the hit on the economy, on the lives of the people, and we would rebound from it quicker. But I think individual property owners would say, well, why do I have to bear the burden of that?
That is what some people are saying. People like North Carolina Congressman Chuck Edwards.
What's difficult is the premise that our government would tell a property owner what they can and they can't do on their own property. There are reasonable regulations that we should consider out there, but number one, I think we need to consider the rights of the people that own the property.
Disaster recovery has always been fraught. Telling people who just survived a catastrophe to rebuild to higher standards often doesn't go over well, and that conflict grinds communities down. That's what New York found after Superstorm Sandy hit in 2012.
We put a lot of stuff right back where it was.
Craig Fugate was the head of FEMA during the recovery as the state struggled to implement a series of government programs that sent homeowners even on the same block in different directions. Some worked to elevate their homes, some took buyouts and leveled their homes, and some did nothing. I asked Fugate, what's the plan here?
There is no plan. People like to think there's a plan, but understand the complexity of one, I got to deal with property rights and property owners. I also have to understand most of this is economically driven. Developers will come in there and start putting cash on the streets to buy out distressed property.
These competing forces leave many communities stuck halfway through a recovery as disasters become forgotten with time. On Staten Island, after the government spent more than $200 million buying out homeowners' properties, some people now want to see those empty lots redeveloped, like Staten Island Borough President Vito Fisella.
You have some of the best views around and underappreciated of the water. We should welcome people to build near the water when possible and bring life back as opposed to watching empty lots.
Nobody just steps back and says, let's think about how we can really fix this right.
Brad Gare helped lead disaster recovery for New York City and FEMA and now works as a consultant for Tidal Basin.
That big vision. It runs out of steam. The train runs out of steam because you just get worn down.
When Hurricane Harvey left a third of Houston underwater in 2017, the city turned its focus to engineering its way out of the problem, spending millions to shore up its dams, build storage basins, and widen drainage canals. But many of them haven't panned out the way people hoped either.
So you can see where it's flat here. They widen this all the way out 30 miles.
On a recent afternoon, Phil Bedian, a civil engineer who studies flood models at Rice University, stood next to one of the city's enormous man-made concrete canals. It was recently upgraded, mostly since Harvey, at a cost of $480 million.
So how much did it lower the water?
According to my calculations, it lowered it in the range of a foot or so.
But Harvey flooded this neighborhood with 4 to 6 feet of water.
Yes, it did.
Is this what we're doing now? Well, saving a foot?
I think they just had no choice but to move forward. They had the money. It had been approved. Remember, these are Army Corps of Engineers projects that take decades to come to fruition.
Do we have decades?
I'm not sure we do.
As hurricane season begins this month, the question now is which community will face these tough decisions next. Laura Sullivan, NPR News.
For more, listen to NPR's Up First podcast, Unprepared, and watch Frontline's documentary, Hurricane Helene's Deadly Warning, streaming now.
Canadian writer Dan Rubenstein traveled from Ottawa to New York City by paddling.
I kind of liken it to walking on water, Jesus illusion notwithstanding.
All right, not a miracle necessarily. He stood on an inflatable paddleboard.
And he says it has better views than a kayak.
You can look down into the water, so you can see fish, you can see plants, you can see yourself more integrated into this aquatic environment.
Okay, Canada to New York City, 1,200 miles round trip, down the Ottawa River to Montreal. Then, if I understand the maps, you portage, you go overland for a little bit, and then you're in the river system going down the Hudson River all the way to New York, where he met a friend.
Where we went out and around the Statue of Liberty, so much boat traffic, so many tour boats, police boats, tugboats, tankers, etc.
All right, how's this for multitasking? On the way, he wrote about how water helps people, the benefits of being in blue space.
The aquatic equivalent of green space, whether it's a vast ocean or a river or an urban pond or even a fountain.
Rubenstein says when he'd wake up anxious about his work or about turning 50 or about climate change, he would paddle.
Within an hour of setting out in the morning, I would stop worrying. Sometimes I would just stop thinking, looking at and listening to the plants and animals. I'd be talking to whatever animals I saw. So I really felt at home in that environment.
And Rubenstein says the 11-week voyage helped him to explore communities.
Blue space does have this capacity to connect people. It makes us feel good. It slows us down. And because of the dangers of water, we tend to watch out for one another when we're around water. So because of those three things, I think it has this capacity to help people see one another as fellow human beings. And that's something that's, one could say, in short supply these days.
Dan Rubenstein wrote a book about it all. It's called Waterborne, a 1,200-mile paddleboarding pilgrimage. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.